This episode is brought to you by our friends and sponsors, Ricky and Kelly at Groenfell Meadery in Vermont. Ricky and Kelly are very excited about two limited edition meads. First, there's the latest entry into the Sour Mead Maker series, Raspberry Lime Ricky. It's a tart blend of honey from Vermont bees along with raspberry and lime, and it features amazing label art from artist Brandy Slavinsky, who won a contest to design the packaging, and Groenfell Rose Brew, a craft mead with rose hip and rose water. This one is a collaboration with Stormforge Studios, bringing to life a drink from their live-action fantasy show, Tavern Brawl. Raspberry Lime Ricky is at 5.1%, and Rose Brew is at 6.5%, so they're very quaffable. Check them out along with all the other delicious offerings, and have them sent to you at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell.com. Groenfell. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 18th, 2021. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Hodge from Oregon Fruit answers your questions on how to brew with fruit purees. How do you make the most out of those delicious fruit flavors in your beers and meads? If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives or our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing and you will be rewarded. And thanks to everybody who is helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters this week will see an early release along with behind-the-scenes footage from my Belgian-inspired strong brown ale video episode, brewed with some of the malt sent to us by Sugar Creek Malting up in Indiana. Sadly, that beer is just a memory, but it's a pleasant memory. And I've got two more in the fermenter right now, making use of the great weather that we've been having, at least periodically. I've done a smoked beer with 100% Rauch malts and a freaky little beer with wind malt, smoked lavender, Swedish Korsta hops, and Imperial Rustic, which should give it some farmhouse and or Saison character. I think I've done a pretty good job of balancing the flavors. I hope it'll be very sessionable and fun to take us into spring. That wort with the wind malt, which is not kilned at all, but dried in the sun, is maybe the lightest wort in color of any 100% barley beer that I've brewed. I posted a picture of it on the Instagram. And I don't know, maybe some of my 100% white wheat beers have been as light, but I'm very interested to tasting how that comes out. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Listener Lee writes, after having some fairly serious health issues that has left him disabled, unfortunately, Lee says he has a lot of time to sit and do nothing. So I stumbled across your link and have been catching up on your podcasts and videos, which has inspired me to drag out my old brewing gear and start relearning. Lee says, I realize that sparging is not required in brew in a bag, but I'd like to pick your brains on what I can do to maximize my efficiency. I'm going to scale down to 1, 2, and maybe the rare 3-gallon batches. Glad you found us, Lee, and that you're on the mend. And all the best for your full recovery, or as best as you can do. We've got a lot of archived episodes to keep you occupied for a long time in the meantime. As far as brew-in-a-bag efficiency is concerned, here are some of my thoughts. You can mill finer with brew in a bag than standard all grain, you know, because, of course, you don't have to worry about a stuck sparge because you're brewing in the bag. You just take the bag right out. I stir my mash every few minutes to make sure that the enzymes have contact with the starches. And again, you don't have to worry, you know, with a traditional mash tun, you know, you don't want to stir the mash too much because you want to establish that grain bed. No worries about that with the bag. With small batches, I use a warm oven to put the pot in to help maintain mash temperature, and that's very helpful. You can use a refractometer or a hydrometer to make sure that your mash is done. With my Brunabag batches, the gravity tends to rise even after the 60-minute mark. So, for instance, with this latest batch, with the wind malt, I mashed for 75 minutes until my refractometer finally stopped rising. And don't be afraid to squeeze the bag a bit. Insert your own joke here. But, you know, I found that there's some sugars left over in the bag. And while there have been some experiments, I've seen that it might affect your clarity. If you're looking for efficiency, you might want to do some bag squeezing. Well, that's my experience. If y'all have any advice out there for Lee on maximizing efficiency in brewing a bag, especially with small batches, drop me a line and I'll pass on the information. I love using Brew-in-a-Bag, and you know I love my electric Brew-in-a-Bag system from our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. I did some research, and it looks like I got my Warthog system back in March of 2015. So happy birthday to my electric system from highgravitybrew.com. I can't believe it's been 6 years. I've got the 240-volt system with the EBC-130 controller. And I've got my brew day down now, so it really goes smoothly, usually. I set up my 15-gallon kettle on the patio, pour in all the water from my batch, and yesterday I forgot to close the valve on the kettle, so my feet got a little wet. But, that wasn't the fault of the system. It's pilot error, as they say. I set the Warthog controller to mash. And then I went about setting up my cameras, gathering ingredients, and, you know, whatever else I've got to do. And by the time I get all that under control, you know, my water was heated. And then it's just doughing in and letting the controller hold the mash rock solid. And I do have a pump, which is helpful for large volume or high gravity batches. That's when I use that. After the mash, I switch over to the boil mode on the controller and set the power level to about 80%. And by the time I rinse out my brewing bag and the little metal colander insert and all that stuff, you know, my wort is usually about ready to add the hops. So easy. If you're not brewing with electricity yet, highgravitybrew.com can help you take the pain out of propane. They've got a system that's just right for you. From 5 gallons to 2 barrels, Desiree and Dave have you covered. Check them out and pick out your new gear. And spring into spring at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. That's highgravitybrew.com. Okay, let's talk to Chris Hodge of Oregon Fruit to talk about how best to use fruit purees. Chris Hodge, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you, James. Great to be here today.
You are with Oregon Fruit Products, and y'all have been very kind in sending me some samples of your Oregon fruit puree. And that's I have trouble saying fruit puree.
Don't join the crowd, because virtually everybody who tries to say it the first time messes it up. So you're not alone, James.
I may say it slowly just to make sure that I'm I'm enunciating. I swear I haven't been drinking. It's only noon, so. So you do have you are a certified Cicerone, so that's impressive, first of all. And then you told me before we started recording that you have a little bit of experience in brewing and that with your company that you wanted to sort of introduce people into the world of home brewing.
Yeah, you know, it's really been an interesting career. And I've spent since 1984 till today in and around the beer business. So in 84, we started a small distributorship. Back then, there wasn't many craft brewers around. In fact, they were called microbrewers then. And part of our goal was to make sure that the folks we hired to work in our distributorship were well-educated in the world of beer. So we made a old-fashioned keg home brew system, and everybody who joined the team, we had cut their teeth on designing a recipe and then making their own first home brew. So I was able to partake and learn and was, you know, became very interested in brewing, albeit never an expert.
Well, if you're a home brewer, you know, some home brewers may consider themselves experts, but
many do. Trust me, many do.
There's always something to learn. This isn't my first exposure to your products. A few years ago, I did a rye-based kettle-soured session beer, and I divided that up into different batches. And I was looking for stuff to use, and I was in the grocery store around the pie filling section, and there was this little can of Oregon tart cherries, whole tart cherries. Yep. And I put that into the split up the beer and put that into the secondary, and it was actually pretty nice. The cherry flavor came through, and I was pretty happy with it. What are these products that is this a new product that you're rolling out and introducing, and how is that different from, say, like, you know, something that you'd see in the pie aisle?
Well, thanks for bringing that up. You know, one of the things that Oregon Fruit has been known for the first 50 of the 85 years that we've been in existence as a family-owned business, is we were known for our specialty canned fruit. And when I mean specialty, it truly was straight off the vine, the highest quality fruit that we would put in cans. And that business model was great back in the day when, you know, people buying canned fruit, canned vegetables was part of their daily life. You know, fast forward to the 80s and 90s when, you know, that whole idea of spending, you know, good money on a really high quality fruit in a can kind of started to wane. And that's when the company at the time owned by the Geller family decided, you know, we need to, you know, spread our wings a little bit and get into other fruit type products. And they bought this Heinz pasteurizer from the Heinz ketchup factory, and they installed it in their plant, which he had been in for, you know, 50-some-odd years. And they started making purees out of the fruit. So they would, you know, much of the fruit they would harvest would come in from the Willamette Valley and surrounding farms. And some of the fruits that maybe weren't the highest quality, they would use and turn it into this puree. Well, you know, for about 10 years, they used the puree for a myriad of very small food ingredient projects. Then it was in about 1995 or 96, craft brewing was just starting to play with fruit. And what they did was they had a couple brewers in Oregon. There was a woman who now currently, Terry Farendorf, who is an amazing brewer in her own right. She was working at Steelhead Brewing. She says, you know, I'm going to try this raspberry puree in a fruit beer. And it was just a phenomenal hit. In fact, it became sort of the talk of the brewing town at that time. There was also a brewer in Louisiana, Abita Brewing, and they were going to be releasing as a year-round item a purple haze, and they too were using the raspberry puree from Oregon Fruit. So that was sort of the genesis of what happened when Oregon Fruit realized that, hey, these aseptic purees, you know, they have a future. So fast forward to 2011, when a new family bought the company and began injecting a little bit of extra money into the company and realizing that aseptic fruit purees with no additives really could have cross-functional impact across both beverage and food manufacturing. So that was sort of the history of how these purees really came into their own right.
And is this the first time that that you've started packaging them into containers small enough to appeal to homebrewers?
No, that actually was a long relationship well before the Miletuses purchased the company and well before I started at Oregon Fruit, where Country Malt Group, at the time Brewcraft, worked with Oregon Fruit to develop a pureed product that they could put in a pack size that would appeal to home brew shops across the U.S. And at that time, Brewcraft was and may still be the leader of supplying these home brew shops with all kinds of amazing fruit supply or brewing supplies. So they said, hey, we think there's a space for fruit in our home brew supply inventory portfolio. Could you can something for us? Oregon Fruit says, yeah. So they began to can these purees, and it was called Vintner's Harvest. And up until last year, Vintner's Harvest was a very vibrant and great portfolio item for brewcraft / country malt that brew shops across the U.S. and in Canada would carry on their shop on their shelves.
So people may have been using your product and not even know it.
Well, most did not. I think in small print somewhere on that Vintner's Harvest, there may have been, there had to be a little designation that said produced by Oregon Fruit. But I would venture to say that virtually any home brewer who has used a Vintner's Harvest product, they probably now know that they were using an Oregon Fruit puree.
So this is just fruit and only the fruit and nothing but the fruit?
You are correct. Yes. Yeah. And that's the beauty of it. There's two aspects that the brewers and now virtually any, craft beverage manufacturer, maker, love about the product. It is pure fruit. There are no additives. The second most important, quality aspect of it is really vibrant. The color, is exactly what you'd expect if you were to macerate any of the fruits that we currently have. The aromas are captured in the process, which is a very simple heating, cooling process that provides a kill step to make it aseptic / commercially sterile, and it captures all of the aromas, flavors, and essences that you would expect in real fruit. Nothing else is added.
This leads me to a question. I put out there on social media that I was going to be talking to you, and I got some good questions from listeners. Our friend and award-winning mead maker Matt Whitey asks, what is the temperature and the time period used to pasteurize the fruit before the can? Is that something that you can divulge?
Yes. Typically we have to, comply with HACCP regulations because we are a food manufacturer. So the first kill step is fruit that goes into a kettle. The kettle temperatures range between 196 and 205. And the temperature and time really depend upon the fruit. Each type of fruit, depending upon the pH and Brix, has a different temperature to establish that first kill step. Once that happens, minimal amount of time is used just to make sure that we meet federal requirements for HACCP. Then it goes into another holding tank. It is passed through tubes to where it can be quickly cooled down so that it doesn't stay at high temperatures, for more than, 5, 10, 15 minutes, depending upon the fruit time. So we don't like to say it's cooked. It's just heated to provide commercial sterility.
Right. And I talked about that experiment that I did a split batch and added your cherries to one half of that batch. The other half I used chunked fruit, frozen fruit, that wasn't yours. And half of it was mango and half of it was peach. And the beer turned out good, but there was a little pellicle that developed on the top of that beer, and I forwarded a picture of that to my friend Mike Tonsmeyer, the wild fermentationist, and he made the suggestion that it might have been a wild yeast contamination. I guess, since your product is pasteurized, that's not an element that's going to come into play when we use it, right?
That is correct. I think that's when I say that second most important quality of this product is the fact that it is commercially sterile, is that, brewers or whomever is using the fruit can be guaranteed that there aren't going to be any little microbial activities that are going to be produced by the fruit puree. Now, however, we also caution brewers that if they're using the product, once that bag or can is open, the onus is on them to make sure that commercial sterility maintains itself throughout the fermentation process. Because, as there are microbes everywhere, so there's no guarantee, but the risk is really mitigated by using these aseptic purees.
That brings me to another question. You're leading me right into these. Holger, our friend Holger on Facebook says, let me get my reading glasses where I can read it. How long does an opened can of aseptic puree last, say, in the fridge? And what's the best way to keep unused puree, freezing or refrigeration?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, you can just refer back to my last comment that, the commercial sterility is gone the minute it's open. However, we have heard of brewers who, you know, still use good sterility SOPs. Even home brewers are really adept at making sure that they keep everything clean. You know, what we suggest doing is once you open the can, if that's what the pack type you've used, you dump it into a container that has a good tight seal ability to it. And that product can remain refrigerated for between 7 and 10 days comfortably. Again, you're still at risk because any air contaminant or anything else, you know, that you have in your refrigerator, the broccoli, et cetera, you want to make sure that you've done your best job to keep it as clean as possible.
Yeah, once you open the can in your own house, there's dust particles and dog dander and whatever
exactly.
else floating around in the air.
So
you can't guarantee that it's going to keep. It's just like any other food product, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And we've heard I've heard some stories recently of some breweries with having to recall some fruit beers, you know, because of post canning fermentation activity. I'm assuming that's in the brewing process and not the fact that they're just using fruit in the first place, right?
Yeah, you know, great question, James. You know, having spent 30 plus years on the beer distribution side as a CEO of a brewer, and you know, seeing all facets of what happens in the beer world. You know, I've seen beer recalls for, you know, dozens of different types of reasons. And fermentation or, you know, secondary fermentation in a can or bottle can happen with or without fruit. We do suggest that brewers, you know, play at their own risk if they're using fruit after cold crash. And one of the things that we have, you know, continued to work with brewers on, you know, worldwide, not just North America, is, you know, hey, here's some tried and tried methods for fruit dosing. You can use these recommendations, and, you know, there's no guarantee that there's not going to be secondary fermentation. But typically when a brewer uses fruit during primary fermentation and allows the sugars to completely ferment out, chances of secondary fermentation are very, very minimal. So what we're seeing, it's not unusual for brewers now to add after cold crash, and then they play at their own risk.
Yeah. If you're adding after a cold crash, the risk is that there may be some yeast still in suspension that might still go to work, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, look at the advent of the hazy craze. I mean, you know, circle back 6, 7, 8 years ago when all of a sudden everybody wanted to have stuff floating in their beer. You know, I remember when Widmer brought out their Hefeweizen in the late 80s, early 90s, and people thought, what the hell is all that stuff? And there's like, well, that's yeast and other, you know, protein particulates. But, yeah, there's going to be yeast. Unless you're really, you know, using a centrifuge for every, you know, brew and you're able to, you know, pasteurize, the chances of having yeast and then, you know, sugars for that yeast to eat is pretty high if you add after cold crash.
Nate on Twitter asks, for beer, when do you add the fruit? The optimum contact times before racking off the fruit? Nate says, I find that the fruit sugar ferments off and leaves a somewhat sour/tart or less sweet fruit flavor behind. How do you preserve the perceived fruit sweetness? Back sweeten or adding honey malt, he says.
You know, there are no perfect methods for this question. I would say that we have seen the best results of a full round fruit flavor and aroma, I should say, not just flavor. When you add the fruit during primary, day 2, 3, or 4, we like to see, and most brewers have had really good results when they're adding the first dosing at high Kreuzen. Several brewers also wait until the end of primary for some top noting with, you know, the balance of the fruit to really give it that sort of burst of, you know, fruit sweetness and or flavor so that not all the sugars are completely gobbled up. And we've also heard of brewers, and, you know, if you're a home brewer, I mean, there's no problem if you want to do primary and also, you know, leave 20-30% of the fruit for some top note dosing after cold crash, obviously because you have full control over the packaged beer after it's completed.
Yeah, no, it works best, I would assume, if you're kegging the beer to add fruit. Then that way you can make sure that you keep it cold.
Big time. Yeah.
But I would assume that it would be more hazardous if you're bottling the beer to back sweeten before a packaging that way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, brewers, you know, around the world, everybody's had an exploding bottle or two in their cellar, in their garage, in their basement, in their cupboard, wherever. And, you know, it's not just fruit. It could be anything. So, you know, again, using fruit, in my mind, is one of the best ways you can, you know, age a beer, too. So if you're going to let the beer be in contact with the fruit, we've had brewers who will leave, you know, the contact time for, you know, months in a barrel, for example, or in an aging vessel of any type. And, you know, harken back, you know, 300 or 400 years to when the Belgians really designed, you know, using fruit. Contact time could be 12 to 18 months.
Hmm. And I guess, does it depend on the fruit? I mean, are some fruits more fermentable than others?
Yeah, I mean, dark sweet cherry, for example, comes in with Brix right between 24 and 26. So you got a lot of fermentables there. You know, strawberries are hovering down in the, you know, 9 and 10 range. So every you know, fruit has its own Brix and pH that, you know, we provide, and so does CMG and homebrew shops, will provide spec sheets and C of A's for any fruit that we sell. So you can see a much tighter range. And again, these Brix and pH ranges are a range. That's why if homebrewers really want to dial in their recipes, I would strongly encourage them to request a C of A on any particular fruit. So it really allows them to play more accurately with the level of Brix in each fruit.
Are those available on your website? I don't see like a specific gravity estimation or on the package itself.
They're by request. We the reason being is C of A's especially because they're lot specific, and we constantly are blending throughout the course of the year. So a brewer who buys a can of fruit in January, you know, that same fruit that they might buy in, you know, October, in theory would have a very tight range of Brix and pH that would be very similar to what they used earlier in the year. So we're constantly blending, but each lot will have a various Brix and pH levels in a tight range, of course.
You mentioned strawberries. David asks, homebrewers always claim strawberries aren't a good fruit for beer because the flavor doesn't come through. However, I see commercial beers with strawberries all the time. What's the best method for getting the strawberry flavor to come through the finished beer?
Well, just use more of it, David.
No. Says the director of sales.
No, I really, you know, strawberry for me is it's one of the most delicate fruits that we sell. It's got the shortest shelf life. There's also, you know, all the research we've heard, and again, I am not an expert brewer, nor am I a scientist or a doctor, but I will tell you this. Strawberries are amazing when they're fresh off the vine. Mm. Every day that passes that a strawberry sits anywhere, whether it's in our processing facility or, you know, in a can or whatever, it just becomes a less intense fruit. And we tell brewers that. It also has the capacity to throw off really strange phenolic attributes in a beer. And there have been countless studies. Again, I'm not going to profess to know all the reasons why, but, you know, one of the things we've heard from brewers is like, I get this really phenolic note with, you know, strawberry. So the science behind strawberry is that it's super delicate. And I wasn't kidding when I said, you know, a lot of brewers just, you know, they add it either, they just add double the dosing they typically would of a regular fruit, or they will top note with essence or one-offs. And, you know, we have brewers, and hey, it's okay. If you want to use real fruit, fantastic, but there's nothing wrong with to top note to get that aroma of a strawberry, for example. And you don't need much essence to get the aroma of a strawberry. And we all know 80% of what you taste is what you smell.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a quick break to talk about our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. Casey at Imperial tells me they're expanding their guaranteed in-stock program for commercial customers. Imperial now has 10 strains that are guaranteed to ship to commercial breweries from both their East and West Coast production facilities. This gives commercial customers additional flexibility to brew what they want, when they want, and it helps Imperial maintain their commitments to quality, transparency, and service. On the homebrew side, you know we love Imperial Organic Yeast. My stir plate is dusty because of their leading pitch rate of 200 billion cells per easy-to-open package. If you are a commercial brewer, check out imperialyeast.com and get in contact with them about how they can guarantee having 10 strains of yeast guaranteed to ship to you from both the East and West Coast. And if you're a home brewer, check out your local homebrew store for Imperial. Imperialyeast.com. We love them. Imperialyeast.com. It's a common practice in mead making to stabilize, make the yeast go dormant at least, so there's no more fermentation, and then to back sweeten with either more honey or more fruits or things like that. Is that something that that you're seeing in the beer world too?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I have just been blown away by how creative and innovative brewers are getting. And I've learned so much just in the last year with the advent of these real-fruited hard seltzers, real-fruited canned cocktails. And, you know, in the beer world, and cider and mead world as well, we're seeing brewers that literally have completely taken the gloves off. They're doing everything they can to, whether it's extract more fruit flavor or enhance fruit flavor or enhance the body of a product. I can't tell you the number of things I've heard that brewers are doing to really just change the spectrum of the organoleptic, experience that people have with these craft beverages. It's mind blowing. And I got to hats off to them. You know what? They had to do a student body left when COVID hit. And now everybody's like, you know what? There are no rules anymore. Serious.
Now, of course, if you stabilize your beer, you're going to have to force carbonate. The option of bottle conditioning, adding yeast or adding sugar at bottling time and expecting, yeast to carbonate the beer, that's out the window.
Yeah, yep.
Johannes from Twitter says, I appreciate any advice on how best to use fruit purees. In making sour smoothie beers like Renhouse Brewing's La Frescas series. It's basically a Berliner Weiss with fruit puree added after fermentation directly to the serving keg. He asked about ratios, et cetera. That may be that goes along the lines of what we've been talking about.
Yeah, the good news about sour beers in general is whether it's a traditional wild ferment sour or a lactic kettle sour, we're seeing that sours scream out for fruit. It's been really a huge help to have brewers who have experimented with all types of fruit and souring. The top noting after the sour souring has occurred and then fruiting right before kegging is not uncommon. Dosing really depends on fruit type. Some of the darker fruits, the raspberries, the blackberries, the dark sweet cherries, the big, robust, in-your-face fruits, you can literally get away with, a half a pound per finished gallon of beer. And then the more delicate fruits, the blood oranges, the strawberries, the red tarts, the ones that typically just aren't that potent, you're going to have to add anywhere between a pound and a half to 2 pounds to every finished gallon of beer.
Wow. Wow. And these cans I've got in front of me here, they're 3 pounds, 3 pounds, 1 ounce, in fact, or 1.39 kilograms.
Yep.
Why that extra ounce?
Well, talk to the can manufacturer, James. We don't make the cans. No, I'm serious. So, and that I say that with all seriousness, though, because in the world of canning, much like, our company, cans have kind of gone the way of the dodo bird. If you're not, and can manufacturers will tell you, how often do you see those big old tin cans anymore, So they've become really standardized. So that's the reason. Also, I got to say hats off to the folks that at Brewcraft back in the day, well before my time, is that they chose that amount because typically that's the perfect amount for a 5 gallon carboy.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go. Y'all sent dark sweet cherry, passion fruit, pineapple, and blackberry. Now, you know, any one of these will go good in a mead. But I'm thinking the passion fruit. I do this beer, an extract beer, where I only boil for 15 minutes and then I add just a whole bunch of hops, you know, to get this really juicy, fruity, you know, hoppy beer without a whole lot of bitterness. And I'm thinking, you know, the passion fruit puree in that, it sounds amazing.
You just hit on one of my favorite fruits in our portfolio. Passion fruit is one of those gems that people, there's a lot of misunderstanding. They think tropical, so they think it's going to be super sweet and like luscious. It's one of the most intense fruits we sell, and it really goes well in a sour beer. It really goes well in any beer, but you know, it's one of those fruits where I said, you know, a pound per finished gallon, this fruit you can get away with less than a half a pound. The intensity really shines through. It adds, it doesn't add that sort of sharp, bitter edge tartness. It's just a really round tropical tartness that is enhanced by the subtle nuances that you get from the tropical notes. I love that fruit.
Now, if you're adding these to the keg, is the puree, are you going to have an issue with, say, the puree settling out in your corny keg and then having to, you know, work through some sort of, you know, sludgy sediment? Or, you know, how does that work?
Yeah, if you're not dosing until after cold crash, you're definitely going to have, you're going to have to deal with sediment for sure. Now, some of our fruits, like, for example, passion fruit has more juice-like consistency, so you don't have the heavy solids. In fact, there's not really much solid activity in there. So between starch, pectin, and protein solids, that will the level of those in your fruit puree will then cause, you know, the amount of settling you can expect. And it's very obvious the minute that you open any of the cans or bags is that you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Dark sweet cherry, when you open that, it's literally, you know, the viscosity on that is very thick. So you can kind of just, you can get that sort of like thumbnail figure, like, okay, this is probably going to have some settling effect.
Now, in, say, in meads, if you want a clear mead, do you recommend using a pectin enzyme with all of the fruits or any of the fruits?
Yes, there are a few fruits that we actually do some proprietary enzyme treatments for. You won't see that on the label because it's in such small amounts that all it does is break down pectins. You know, things that are very fibrous, like mango, pineapple, a couple others that also have high pectin levels just naturally occurring in their fruit, will use some enzymes to break that down. But I will tell you that the brewers that really have, I guess, perfected enzyme use, they can get a clear beer with any fruit in the portfolio. And it doesn't take much pectinase to make it work either. And the good news about pectinase, you know, traditionally you'd like to see about 6 to 12 hours of contact time at room temps or even higher if possible. But I've seen brewers who will add pectinase while they're dosing the fruit and still end up with a really clear end product.
Huh. Now, do you think the pineapple would be a better pairing with my, you know, my juicy late-hopped pale ale than the passion fruit?
Yes. Yes, I think that the thing about the pineapple is we use, it's a combination of grade A pineapple fruit chunks, and then we mix that with pineapple juice. It's really luscious. You open the can, you open the bag, you just get this huge pineapple aroma. And you know as well as I do that over the past, you know, 10 years, hop growers all over the world are using fruits to describe their hop profiles. And pineapple is probably one of the most commonly used adjectives to describe a hop note. So the pineapple puree is just a natural fit with a hoppy pale ale.
Yeah, whenever I'm at a salad bar and I'm near the pineapple section, I always get thirsty.
Jane, I got to tell you, salad bars right now, I wouldn't recommend them.
Oh, well, yeah, the sneeze guards, anything with a sneeze guard is a thing of the past, unfortunately, for now. But,
exactly.
But I'm thinking back in the good old days.
Totally.
What are brewers using the dark sweet cherry for?
You know, we're seeing a lot of brewers who are using it in some of these heavier smoothie milkshake beers. It's gorgeous. The consistency just adds a voluptuous thickness body feel to it. Plus, you don't have to use a lot of it. It's really, really intense. You know, when you use your, if you haven't used your can, when you open that baby up, just be ready for a full, you know, mind-blowing experience. It's just really rich. And we're also seeing that it's a really great fruit to use if you're doing any barrel aging. It provides such long-lasting, deep, rich flavors for anything barrel-aged.
Yeah, I could. That would pair well with the with wood character, I would assume.
Oh yeah, and you know, any stouts, porters, it really works well with if you're going to use any vanilla in your brewing. It works really well with any spices you might be using. It's just such a great foundation fruit that, yeah. But you got to think big with it for sure. Whatever you're going to do with it, it's going to be big.
So I didn't ask, where does your fruit come from?
Well, you know, little storytelling I did back, well, you know, for the first 50 years, you know, back when farming was still a very viable way to make a living, Oregon Fruit was sourcing probably at least 70 to 80% of their fruit, you know, within 150 miles of the facility in Salem. And keep in mind, that facility has been in the same location pretty much up until 2 years ago when we moved just across Salem into a larger facility. So, you know, the Willamette Valley being one of the luscious growing regions in the world, you know, it was really easy. And the portfolio at that time, I think there were probably about 14 or 15 regular year-round fruits that they would choose from around the local farming area. Well, these days, we've just had to broaden our, you know, scope. So we source locally when possible. So, for example, blueberries, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, dark sweet cherries, red tart cherries, anything that's sort of, you know, common stone fruit or a berry typically can still be sourced, you know, within the Willamette Valley or at least, you know, Willamette and Yakima Valleys. Now, tropicals, of course, we have to go to places like Mexico, Ecuador, Brazil, Costa Rica, the growing regions, the natural growing regions of the tropicals. Citrus, same thing. So, again, we're still, you know, trying to source local, but it's just for, you know, the consumers today, you have to have a really, you know, dynamic and changing portfolio to keep people's interest.
How many of these purees do you make?
We currently have 23 year-round items.
Wow.
And every year, we release 4 seasonals. Our last seasonal was Cara Cara Orange. We released fourth quarter of this year, and like many seasonals we release, demand goes through the roof, A, because it's new, and then B, we realize that, oh my God, we've released another fruit that people absolutely have to have all the time. So in the last 6 years, pineapple, mango, pink guava, passion fruit were all seasonals that now have become year-round items.
Huh.
Meyer lemon, key lime, those were seasonals 2 years ago. They're now year-round.
Oh, wow.
Our first seasonal of 2021 will be dragon fruit that will should be released around the first part of April. And depending upon demand, you know, I'm not going to say it's going to be year-round, but that's kind of what's happened to our portfolio. We just get such high demand, you know, and consider that we're doing business across North America in about 9 export markets. You know, there's just a lot of demand out there for all kinds of fruit.
So how can our listeners get a hold of these themselves?
Well, we sell business to business. We don't sell to consumers. So if you were looking to buy our cans, you would want to reach out to Country Malt Group. They are essentially the exclusive distributor of that particular item at this time. And we do not stock that product at our facility. So if you're looking for a 49-ounce can for any of the purees, they're your best bet, and they're a great partner of ours. If you have a 1 or 2 or 3 barrel system that you're, you know, just playing around with and you want to make a bunch of beer for your friends and family, we do sell 42-pound boxes that can be sold directly to the public.
Wow.
And a 42-pound box is about 5 gallons of fruit puree.
Mm. Just add water or just add yeast. And you...
Pretty much, yeah. We literally had a winemaker in Eugene that she says, hey, I fell in love with your fruit. I was from one of my home brewing friends, and I want to make a wine. Can I buy a drum of your raspberry puree? It's like, sure, come on down, pick it up.
I can't say the phrase raspberry puree without thinking of Prince. So,
oh, God rest his soul. Love Prince.
the kind you find in a secondhand store.
Totally. James, we could talk for hours.
Yes, but we won't.
I'm sure your listeners appreciate that.
No, this has been fun and tons of good information, and I appreciate your spending time, and I certainly appreciate your sending the product, and viewers of Basic Brewing Video will be seeing those in a beer and or mead sometime soon. So I appreciate it, and good luck with all the fruit.
Thank you. You know, and please keep my, contact information handy. I love to talk about fruit and beer. And as you can tell, I'm extremely passionate about it. In fact, my passion has grown now that I'm on the other side. I'm selling ingredients to brewers and mead makers and cider makers. So we love to be a resource for information. And we're very proud to share everything we're learning every day from all of these craft beverage makers.
So can I forward emails from listeners, specific questions to you?
Absolutely.
Oh, there you go. You may regret it. I don't know.
Well, you know, there's one thing I've never regret, and that's every conversation I've had is I learned something. So I'm not going to necessarily be the guy who's going to provide all the answers, but I can certainly provide a lot of intel that could be useful.
Awesome. I appreciate it, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Have a good afternoon.
Thanks again to Chris. Just to reiterate, if you're using or used to using Vintner's Harvest purees, and now you're seeing Oregon Fruit purees at your homebrew store, same stuff, different label. Don't worry. I'm looking forward to playing with some of these purees and maybe sharing some with Steve, probably with my next batch. I'm looking at putting the pineapple to good use. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.